Jimmy Lee Bayless was trying to conceal his annoyance. From the start, he'd been nervous about the scam, even though Drake McBride had promised that it would make both of them rich beyond their wildest dreams. "Let me handle this," Jimmy Lee Bayless told his boss.
"But we got, like, bandits on the loose," Drake McBride said. "Outlaws, pirates, whatever."
"You seriously think the cops will come chasing after pipe thieves way out here in the middle of nowhere? They got bigger fish to fry."
"Probably just dope addicts," Drake McBride muttered. "Meatheads. Where are they going to sell 2 tons of pipe?"
He walked back to the truck where Melton was puffing on a dead cigarette butt. "I'm sweating to death in this stuff," he complained, and began to strip off the bubble wrap.
"Whoa there!"
Drake McBride made a timeout sign with his hands.
"No offense, son, but I'm not in the mood to deal with a buck-nicking man. Keep your plastic jammies on."
Jimmy Lee Bayless told Melton that he would take him to Walmart on the way into town. "I'll buy some new clothes and a hot lunch, too."
"Thanks, man. What about the overtime?"
Jimmy Lee Bayless looked at Drake McBride, who made a sour face.
"Hey, I spent all night out here," Melton said. "Them red ants taking chunks from my hide.
Are you saying I wasn't on the company clock?" He held up his arm so that the president of Red Diamond Energy could see the gummy red abrasions left by the hardened glue which Jimmy Lee Bayless had pried with a screwdriver from the bark of the tree.
"I think you'll live," Drake McBride remarked.
Jimmy Lee Bayless said, "Tell us about the man who attacked you." Melton admitted that he hadn't gotten a clear look at the guy.
"He had a ski cap pulled down to his eyes, so I couldn't really see his face all that great."
"Was he young or old?"
"I couldn't say," Melton replied. "But he was real strong and real crazy."
Drake McBride frowned.
"Dope fiend. What did I tell you?"
"No, man, he wasn't high or nothing. Just whacked out mean," Melton said. "When he pasted me to that damn tree, he said I was bear bait. That's what he called me. Real nice, huh?"
Jimmy Lee Bayless asked, "Did he have a weapon?"
"I don't know. Probably."
Meaning the answer was no, thought Jimmy Lee Bayless. Melton was too embarrassed to admit that he'd been captured by and lost a load of expensive pipes to an unarmed intruder.
"Listen to me, son," Drake McBride said. "We're not going to call the cops, okay? Red Diamond will deal with this situation, I promise. We'll catch this creep and make sure he doesn't do it to anybody else."
Melton said, "Sooner the better."
"Meantime, you got to promise to zip your lip, okay? You can't tell anybody what happened out here," Drake McBride said. "Not even your wife and kids."
"All I got's a girlfriend." "Not her either," Jimmy Lee Bayless interjected firmly. "Don't mention this to a living soul, understand?"
"Gotcha." Melton was idly popping the bubbles in his see-through plastic coat.
"Hey, when we go by the Walmart, can you buy me some cigarettes? That wacko got my last pack when he swiped my pants."
"Sure," Jimmy Lee Bayless said.
"One more thing. I ain't never been up in a helicopter before."
Drake McBride's expression turned stony.
"Sorry, partner."
"Just a quick spin. Oh, come on."
"You can't get on a chopper if you're not wearing clothes. Strict FAA rules."
"What? You're kidding me," Melton said.
"Yeah, tough break."
Then the president of Red Diamond Energy Corporation turned on one boot heel and signaled for his pilot to fire up the engines. Dwayne Scrodd Sr. was attacking a 20-ounce sirloin steak cooked rare. Dwayne Scrodd Jr. contemplated a large, steaming plate of linguine. Millicent Winship picked at a fresh shrimp cocktail. At her age, she had no patience for chit-chat.
DJ, how are your grades at Truman this term?
She asked her grandson. Not so great, he said, but I aim to do better.
Do you have any homework tonight?
No school tomorrow. It's a teacher work day.
Sounds like a good opportunity to catch up with some of your studies, Mrs. Winship said.
Yes, ma'am. I brought my books home.
I must say you look very serious and handsome.
Embarrassed, Duane Jr. shoveled pasta into his blushing cheeks. Mrs. Winship turned to Duane Sr.
It's quite a difference. I'm impressed.
Don't look at me, Millie. It's all DJ, he said, slurping a cup of coffee. He came back from that camping trip, and I swear it's like there's a stranger in the house. Picks up his dirty clothes, brushes his teeth twice a day, stays up late doing his homework. It's like he turned into a grown-up overnight.
Maybe you should take a lesson, Mrs. Winship wore a frosty smile.
I'll lay off, the boy's father said. They were sitting at an outside table overlooking a marina that was filled with yachts and sailboats. The restaurant was called the Silver Dolphin, and the food was excellent, though expensive. Mrs. Winship was paying the tab, as usual, and happy to do it. She couldn't get over the promising change in her grandson. Duane Sr. was another matter. He showed absolutely no interest in improving himself or his life. Earlier, Mrs. Winship had caught him stashing packets of oyster crackers in his pockets to take home to his obnoxious pet bird. She said, "Tell me, DJ, can you see yourself in college someday?"
"Yes, ma'am, it's possible," Duane Jr. replied. "I'm so pleased to hear that. Have you given any thought to what subject you might like to study?" Mrs. Winship said. "On the path to a career."
Chewing loudly, Duane Sr. interjected, "It's too early for all that. Cut the boy some slack, Millie."
"Environmental science," said Duane Scrod Jr.
"Really?" His grandmother beamed and looked cuttingly at Duane Sr., whose jaw hung open. "I really like the outdoors. It's quiet and pretty," Duane Jr. said. "Plus, I'm into animals and fishing and stuff."
"Ever since you were little, you were an explorer, and fearless, too," Mrs. Winship said fondly.
Duane Sr. began jabbing at his molars with a toothpick, trying to liberate a string of meat. "I'm sorry, but I just don't see Jr. as a scientist. Heck, he's flunking biology for the second or third time."
"Second," Duane Jr. said crossly.
Mrs. Winship glowered at Duane Scrod Sr.
"You listen to me, and listen well. This boy can be whatever he chooses to be once he finds the right role model."
"Ouch," Duane Sr. said, responding not to the insult, but rather to a small hole that he'd punctured in his gums. Duane Jr. put down his fork. "If they wipe out the Everglades and all, people like me won't have anywhere to go except for big cities. And I hate big cities." Mrs. Winship thoughtfully appraised her grandson.
"Tell me about your camping trip," she said.
He cleared his throat. "Caught some bass, saw an otter with two pups, and about a jillion gators as usual." He started eating again.
"Were you there all alone?"
"Pretty much." Duane Jr. didn't look up from his plate.
"Your dad told me about the fire. The headmaster called me as well."
"What fire?"
"Out at the swamp," Duane Sr. cut in. "Now don't act like you never heard about it."
The boy spun some linguine onto his fork. "Oh, yeah, that fire." Mrs. Winship dabbed her mouth with her napkin, which she then refolded neatly on her lap.
"DJ, I'm 77 years old," she said.
which doesn't make me a dinosaur. But I'm not so young anymore either. Time isn't something I can afford to waste. Do you understand?
Yes, ma'am.
So just tell me if you set that fire. Yes or no?
No, ma'am.
Yet the police think you did it. Why is that?
Again, Duane Sr. spoke up. They can't prove a flippin' thing. Otherwise, the boy'd be locked up in juvie hall right now.
Mrs. Winship shot Duane Sr. a peeved look. Gently, she asked her grandson, "Did you have a chance to give your story to the authorities?"
"Yes, ma'am. I straight up told them I didn't do it," Duane Jr. said.
"Those days are over, right?"
"Yes, ma'am. No more fires."
"It's not something that a future environmental scientist should do, burning a swamp."
"No, ma'am."
His grandmother said, "There was a field trip from Truman out there that morning. Somebody could have been hurt badly, DJ, or even killed."
Duane Jr. looked her straight in the eye. "It wasn't me, Graham, I swear."
"All right, I believe you."
"Thank goodness that's settled," said Duane Sr., scanning the restaurant impatiently. "What did our waiter disappear to? I can't wait to have a peek at that dessert tray." It was only her love for Duane Jr. that prevented Mrs. Winship from smacking his father on the top of his hopelessly thick head. To the boy she said, "Your mother told me she wrote you." He seemed surprised. "I didn't get a letter."
"Nothing?"
"Nope."
"Me neither," Duane Sr. piped.
Mrs. Winship was ashamed to think that her daughter could be so selfish and neglectful.
"I'm sorry, DJ. I'll speak with her."
"It's not your fault, Graham."
"How about some dessert?"
"No, thanks."
"Well, I saved plenty of room," Duane Sr. announced heartily, patting his stomach.
Millicent Winship eyed him as if he were a cockroach on a wedding cake.
"We've all had enough," she said sharply and called for the check.
Before Marta's mother dropped them off at the mall, she asked,
"What's the name of the movie?"
Marta faked a cough and turned to Nick, who got the hint.
"It's Spider-Man 7, he said to Mrs. Gonzalez. "Revenge of the Web-Slinger."
He had no idea if there was such a film. He lost count of all the Spider-Man sequels.
"PG?"
"Yeah, Mom, it's PG," Marta said.
"I'll see you back here at 10:30 sharp. Don't be late."
"Bye, Mom," Marta said impatiently.
"Have you got enough money?"
"Goodbye, Mom." Lying about the movie made Nick and Marta feel sneaky and low, but there seemed to be no other choice. Their parents never would have allowed them to spy on Mrs. Starch's house, especially after dark. "According to MapQuest, it's only 2.4 miles, Nick said, studying a map that he'd printed out. He'd gotten Mrs. Starch's address from Libby, who'd found a faculty directory in her father's den after the detective had visited Dr. Dressler's office. Marta said, "I can't believe I forgot a flashlight." Nick had brought one in a pocket of his jacket. "Let's go," he said, and they headed off across the vast parking lot toward the road. Before long, the bright lights of the mall were behind them. Sticking closely to the MapQuest directions, they walked 5 blocks to Mockingbird Court, then 7 more blocks to Grackle Drive. When they reached Mrs. Starch's street, Nick said, "We go west here until the road ends." Marta laughed.
"No way! The old Buzzard actually lives on Buzzard Boulevard? How perfect is that?"
"Number 777, Nick said. "The very last house."
"Naturally."
The streetlights ended when the pavement ran out. As Nick and Marta continued down the dirt road, the night deepened. Nick took out his flashlight.
"Doesn't anybody besides her live out here?" Marta said nervously.
They walked past a couple of houses that were under construction, and another that was roofless and abandoned, probably a hurricane casualty. The woods hummed with crickets and cicadas,
and rustled with other heavier sounds that might have been rabbits or raccoons. Whenever Nick heard something, he aimed the light into the woods to see what it was. But the critters always stopped moving, remaining invisible among the pines and the scrub. Nick assured Marta there was nothing to be afraid of, but he was jumpy, too. Usually he loved hiking through the outdoors, but it was a totally different experience in the black of night. "Do me a favor," Marta said. "Take off the ace bandage." "Why?" "Because you're going to need both arms to carry me back to the mall after I pass out."
"You are not going to pass out."
"No, I'll probably just drop dead from fright," Marta said, "when a rabid bear comes chasing after us."
"Or a panther," Nick joked, trying to lighten the mood.
"Shut up." Every now and then they would glance back, watching for oncoming headlights. But Buzzard Boulevard was as quiet as a graveyard. Nick wondered if he'd be able to run as fast as normal, with one arm bound clumsily behind him.
"How much farther?" Marta asked.
Nick didn't know. The distance seemed longer than it had appeared on the map. He picked up the pace, the white beam of the flashlight bobbing ahead of them. A layer of clouds hung overhead, blocking out the stars and the moon. When a small animal scampered across the road ahead of them, Marta let out a yip and grabbed Nick.
"This was a really terrible idea. Let's go back," she said.
"Shh! We're here." His flashlight illuminated a plain metal mailbox with 3 7s on the side but no name.
"Where's the house?" Marta asked.
"This way." Nick led her along an overgrown trail no wider than a car. He nearly stepped on a coatswhip snake that fortunately slithered into the shadows before Marta noticed it. At the end of the trail, he dropped to a crouch. Marta knelt behind him. Mrs. Starch's house stood alone in the middle of a clearing. Nick counted 3 stories, although the old wooden structure appeared smaller than that, hunched and frail. A bare bulb flickered from the ceiling of the porch, but no light shone in the windows. In the yard, there was no sign of the teacher's blue Prius.
"Nobody home," Marta said, clicking her teeth nervously.
"We'll see."
"Where are you going?"
"To spy," Nick said.
"That was the plan, right?"
Marta stayed close. They darted around the house to the back porch, which was unlit. After creeping up the steps, they searched fruitlessly for a window in which to peek. All the shades were drawn.
"Oh, well, we tried," Marta said, turning to leave. "Get back here."
"Come on, Nick. I'm totally creeped."
"Something's not right."
"Thank you. Now can we please go?"
"What I mean is, look at this place. She hasn't been here for a while."
Nick shined the flashlight back and forth.
"Check out all the spiders."
Marta cringed, but she got the point. Mrs. Starch was a notorious neat freak, yet her porch looked untouched by a broom or mop. Shimmering spider webs hung like tapestries in the corners of the ceiling, while the floor was littered with pine needles and moth casings and lizard poop. Nick said,
"She hasn't been home since the field trip. I'll bet you $20.
"Then who's picking up her mail and driving her car?" Marta said.
"Exactly. That's the mystery.
Smoke knows everything.
He's next on our list. Meantime."
Marta ducked and covered her head.
"A bat just buzzed me. I swear to God."
"Don't be such a wuss." Nick jiggled the knob on the back door, which was locked.
"We should go. It's a long walk back," Marta said, apprehensively eyeing the sky.
Nick scanned the porch until he spotted a large clay pot that contained a wilted palm.
"Give me a hand," he said, pocketing the flashlight.
"We're going to lift that thing."
"Okay. Now you're officially insane.
Hurry up. On the count of 3. The pot budged only a few inches, but that was enough. Nick pointed to a dusty circle in the wood planks, and there lay a key. He smiled.
"Way to go, Sherlock," Marta said.
The key fit easily into the door, and the lock turned with a crisp click.
"You coming?" Nick asked. "Or would you rather stay out here with the bats and black widows?"
11.
Nick wasn't sure if sneaking into Mrs. Starch's house was the bravest thing he'd ever done or the dumbest. But he felt certain that the world's meanest biology teacher wasn't really absent from school because of a family crisis. Something else had happened, something serious, and Duane Scott Jr. had to be involved. "What if she's croaked?" Marta whispered as she closed the door behind them. "What if we find the body?" The same awful thought had occurred to Nick, although he didn't say it aloud. "Then the cops will think we did it. We'll spend the rest of our lives in prison," Marta said. "Keep it down, okay? This is the darkest place I've ever been. Give me your hand." "I've only got one," Nick reminded her, "so you carry the flashlight." It had been a long while since he'd held hands with a girl, fifth grade Jessie Cronenberg. The following summer, her family had moved to Atlanta, and Nick hadn't heard from her since. "Where do you think the old witch keeps all her snakes?" Marta asked, squeezing his fingers. "That's just another lame rumor." "Maybe it's a true rumor. Maybe she whacked her husband, too. They say he disappeared, like 20 years ago." Nick and Marta had moved 3 steps since coming through the door. "I'm totally sketched out," she said. "I know. You're crushing my knuckles." Nick pulled free of her grasp and took back the flashlight. The moment he turned it on, he saw that at least one of the many crazy stories about Mrs. Starch was true. The house was filled with stuffed animals, and not the soft, huggable type that are found in toy stores. Marta said, "We are out of here." "Hold on. It's like a zoo for the dead." Nick, too, had never imagined such a scene. A herd of taxidermied creatures displayed in wild disorder, from wall to wall and from the floor to the rafters. There were birds, mammals, reptiles, and amphibians of many sizes, suspended in poses of coiling, leaping, lurking, snarling, soaring, and pouncing. The animals stared with blank glass eyes through Nick and Marta into infinity. "I told you she was a psycho," Marta whispered. Nick played the beam of the flashlight across the lifeless menagerie. Every mount was identified by a handwritten tag. "I think I know what she's done here," he said. "Besides losing her marbles?" Nick approached a tawny spotted cat the size of a golden retriever. Beside it was a small mottled bird perched sprightly on a stick of driftwood. Mounted overhead on the wall was a homely brown fish with armored ridges. Nick checked the tags on each of them. "They're all endangered species," he told Marta. "That's a panther cub. That's a Cape Sable seaside sparrow. And that ugly thing up on the wall is a short-nosed sturgeon. I know they're endangered because Mrs. Starch has a list in her class syllabus." "You actually read her syllabus? Are you, what, king of the geeks?" "She said it would be on the final." "Whatever, Nick. We gotta get back to the mall before—" "Look here." He fixed the light on a short-eared brown bunny, a lower keys marsh rabbit. "And there," he said, pointing to a stubby-legged lump the size of a hockey puck, "is a baby leather-backed turtle. And this little guy is a—" "Rat," Marta interrupted irritably. "A nasty, smelly rat." "Wrong." Nick pronounced the name slowly from the name tag. "It's Choctaw Hatchie Beach Mouse." "That was my next guess," she said dryly. "Hey, here's one with a collar." Nick grinned as he read it aloud. "Chelsea Everred. Must be somebody special." Marta looked around uneasily. "This place is too freaky." Nick approached a weather-beaten old steamer trunk. The lid was so bulky and warped that he was unable to raise it one-handed. "Help me out," he said to Marta. "No way! What if that's where she stuffed Mr. Starch's body?" "Quit whining!" Together they prized open the antique chest, which, to Marta's relief, was empty. She crinkled her nose. "Smells like my grandpa's attic." A car door slammed outside. Nick instantly clicked off the flashlight. "Get down," he said, tucking Marta to the floor. The glow from the car's headlights lit the edges of the window shades. Nick and Marta heard someone clomping up the steps, making no effort to be stealthy. The next noise was the rattle of the doorknob. "We're so busted," Marta groaned. Nick motioned toward the open trunk. After you.
Nope, not happening. Get in.
They clambered inside and pulled the top shut. The only sound was the thump of footsteps on the pine floor, and the footsteps were not dainty. It could have been Mrs. Starch, who wasn't a dainty woman, or it could have been Smoke, or possibly some other sizable person.
I can't breathe, Marta said wretchedly.
Yes, you can.
Turn on the flashlight, Nick, or I'm going to scream.
Don't tell me you're claustrophobic.
Big time.
Nick said, oh, that's great. He, too, had a fear of confined spaces. The flashlight wouldn't come on until he jiggled the batteries.
Is that better?
He asked. Marta was as pale as wax and drenched with sweat. She looked terrible. The steamer trunk was barely wide enough for the two of them to wedge side by side, sitting with their knees against their chins. For Nick, the cramped fit was as painful as it was unnerving. His taped-up arm was pinned at an unnatural angle against his shoulder blade. He felt like a hawk with a broken wing. Still, he was more concerned about Marta.
It's all my fault. I'm really sorry, he whispered.
She shut her eyes and took a deep, labored breath.
You'll really be sorry if I hurl all over both of us.
The person who'd entered the house was moving around, opening cabinets and cupboards. Gradually, the sounds of the footsteps came closer, making the plank shudder beneath the trunk. Nick wished he'd listened to Marta when she had told him to remove the ace bandage. It would have been helpful to have two good hands available, if needed. He was furious at himself for taking such a foolish risk by entering Mrs. Starch's house. The last thing his mom needed right now was a phone call from the police or, worse, the hospital. And how would she break the bad news to his father? As the footfalls got heavier, Marta's eyes popped open.
Can he see that light inside this thing?
I doubt it, Nick said.
The sides of the old chest appeared solid and seamless.
Better turn it off, just in case. You won't spaz out?
Nope.
Nick killed the flashlight. He could sense Marta trembling at his side. In the smothering blackness, he reached out and found one of her hands. She squeezed back fiercely. By now they could hear the cadence of human breathing outside the steamer trunk. Whoever was in the house, man or woman, was standing only a few feet away. Time seemed to stop dead. Nick felt trapped in his own skin, helpless and on the brink of panic. Taking care of Marta was the only thing that kept him steady. She was in worse shape than he was. His escape strategy was simple because he was short on options. If they were discovered inside the trunk, Nick planned to spring straight upward, shrieking like a lunatic jack-in-the-box. The idea was to scare the pee out of the person in the room in the hope that he, or she, would either run away or have a stroke, at which point Nick and Marta could bolt safely out the back door. Nick figured that the shock tactic had a 50-50 chance of working on Mrs. Starch, who wouldn't be expecting nocturnal intruders. He wasn't so sure about Smoke. It was hard to picture the kid being afraid of anything except possibly a SWAT team. Marta's hand went limp and clammy. Nick gave it a little pinch, but she didn't respond. In the pitch darkness of the steamer chest, he groped frantically for her face to make sure she was still breathing.
"Watch it," she burst out. "Your stupid thumb went up my nose."
"Not so loud."
But it was too late. There was a heavy thud and the trunk moved.
"Come out of there,"
a male voice commanded. Nick and Marta were too frightened to respond. They felt another hard jolt. The guy was kicking the sides of the wooden chest. So much for the element of surprise, Nick thought. Marta poked him sharply as if to say,
"Do something."
Nick shifted his weight to his heels and prepared to launch himself against the bulky lid. At that moment, the trunk went over backwards and the top flew open, spilling him and Marta in a tangled, terrified heap. Standing over them was the man who had overturned the chest.
"Get up," he snapped.
Nick rose first and helped Marta to her feet. He noticed that they landed on the mount of an endangered wood stork, snapping its long, spindly legs so that it was now the same height as a duck. The stranger carried a flashlight of his own, which he aimed harshly in their eyes.
"This must be your first burglary," he said, "because you stink at it."
"We didn't come to steal anything. That's the truth," Nick blurted. He couldn't see the face behind the flashlight, but the voice didn't sound like Dwayne Scrod Jr.'s.
"Let's go for a ride," the man said.
"No, wait," cried Moira. "We're looking for our teacher, that's all."
"Move it!"
They exited through the back door, the stranger prodding them from behind. Outside, there was enough starlight to see that the man was shirtless and wore scuffed trousers and muddy hiking boots. A black ski cap covered his hair, forehead, and ears. He stood about the same height as Smoke, although he was leaner and more muscle-bound. Nick didn't even consider trying to get away because Marta was still so wobbly that she couldn't possibly have outrun the stranger. Mrs. Starch's blue Prius was parked next to the house.
"Hop in the back seat," the man told him.
Marta froze on the spot.
"No way."
"Just let us go," Nick pleaded. "We won't tell the police." The man chuckled dryly.
"I'm the one who ought to be calling the cops. Now you two can either get in the car or be thrown in the car. It's your choice."
Reluctantly, Nick and Marta got in. The stranger whipped the Prius around and drove down the trail to Buzzard Boulevard. He didn't bother switching on the headlights.
"What'd you do with Mrs. Starch?" Nick heard himself ask.
The man eyed him in the rearview mirror.
"The question is, what am I going to do with you?"
Marta reached over and slugged Nick's leg.
"My name's Twilly," the man said, a sure sign, or so Marta believed, that he intended to murder them and dump their bodies in a drainage canal. Otherwise, why would he so casually identify himself and risk being turned into the authorities?
"I'm Nick Waters," said Nick. "My friend's name is Marta."
"What happened to your arm, son?"
Nick was pretty sure that the man named Twilly wouldn't believe the truth, that Nick was training to be a lefty. And in any case, Nick didn't feel like getting into a detailed discussion of his father's war injury.
"Lacrosse," he said. "I sprained it at lacrosse practice."
"Hmm," said the man.
Marta interjected. "Seriously, I was there when it happened."
"Whatever you say."
"Where are you taking us?" Nick asked.
"Depends."
"My mom's meeting us back at the mall," Marta said. "If we're not there, she'll go nuts. I swear to God, she'll call the White House."
The stranger named Twilly said, "I wish I'd had a mom like that." Nick decided that because he was the one who'd gotten them into this awful mess, it was his duty to get them out. And since he couldn't very well overpower the guy and hijack the car, the next best option was to talk some sense into him. "Mister, you don't want to go to jail for kidnapping."
"No, and I don't intend to," the man said evenly.
"Honest, if you just let us go, we won't narc you out. So Mrs. Starch is your teacher."
Marta spoke up. "We're in her biology class."
"And you adore her so much that you busted into her home just to make sure she's all right. That's your story?" The man named Twilly was smiling behind the wheel.
"Not exactly," Nick said. "We didn't break in. There was a key on the porch."
"Ah. What were you doing there?" Nick asked, not expecting to receive a straight answer.
"Looking for some powdered cocoa," the man replied, flicking on the headlights, "and a book. Ever heard of a writer named Edward Abbey?"
Nick and Marta admitted they hadn't.
"No surprise," the stranger said. "I'm sure they don't teach you stuff in that uptight private school of yours. Ed was sort of a bomb thrower, only the bombs were ideals and principles. He liked the earth more than he liked most humans."
A Hannah Montana ringtone went off, and Marta sheepishly smothered her cell phone.
"That's got to be my mom. She's supposed to pick us up outside the movie theater."
"Answer it," the stranger said. "Tell her you'll be right on time, and if you say anything else, I'm turning this car around and we're going to Miami, or maybe Key Largo."
Marta did as she was told. After hanging up, she said, 10:30 sharp. She'll freak if we're not there."
"Understood," said the man named Twilly.
Nick was relieved to see that the car was heading in the direction of the mall, which raised the welcome possibility that they weren't actually being kidnapped.
"How do you know Mrs. Starch?"
he asked the stranger.
"None of your business, Nick Waters." The man tugged the ski cap even tighter on his head.
"We're worried about her, that's all. Nobody's seen her in like a week," Marta said.
"Yeah? Then take out your cute little pink phone again, Princess, and dial this number, 555-2346. Marta switched on the cell phone speaker so that both she and Nick could hear the recording.
"Hello, people. I'll be away from school indefinitely because of an unexpected family matter. You may leave a message at the tone, though it might be a while before I have time to reply. Please accept my apologies in advance. Now here's the beep."
"That's her," Nick said.
"Definitely," Marta agreed.
"Did she sound the least bit dead to you?" the man named Twilly asked. "Gravely ill? Mortally wounded?"
"Not really."
"Then quit worrying," he snapped, "and quit nosing around places you don't belong."
He pulled over a block from the mall in front of a seedy pawn shop. He stepped out of the Prius and ordered Nick and Marta to do the same. Standing in the glow of a gaudy neon sign, the man looked to be in his late 30s, with an athletic build that reminded Nick of his father. The stranger said,
"It would be best if I never set eyes on you two again."
"Oh, don't worry," Marta assured him.
Nick was staring at Twilly's belt, which was made of tanned cowhide and stitched with a row of small sleeves designed to hold bullets. It looked very much like the one worn by the mysterious figure in Nick's video from the field trip to the Black Vine Swamp. The man tapped the face of his wristwatch.
"You've got 6 minutes and 30 seconds before your mama shows up. Get a move on."
"Thank you," Marta said with a grateful sigh. "Thank you, thank you."
"For what?"
"For not killing us and tossing our bodies into a ditch."
"You're welcome," said the man named Twilly.
"I'll tell Aunt Bunny you asked about her." Nick rocked back on his heels.
"Mrs. Starch is your aunt?"
With a thumb, the stranger popped 2 shiny bullets out of his ammo belt. He began tossing them from hand to hand like jelly beans.
"I hate repeating myself," he said.
Nick and Marta started running. They didn't stop until they reached the mall.
12.
Drake McBride had stumbled into the oil business after failing at many other jobs and ruining many other companies. He enjoyed spending money much more than he enjoyed working for it, and this was the secret to his lack of success. It also helped to be lazy, easily distracted, and not very good at math. Every time Drake McBride got himself into trouble, his wealthy father would simply buy a new company for him to noodle with. But now, after several wasted years and millions of wasted dollars, Drake McBride's father finally had lost patience with the free-spending poser who happened to be his youngest son. The Red Diamond Energy Corporation was to be Drake's last chance.
"If you screw up this one,"
his father had warned,
"he won't get another nickel from me."
"Have you checked out the price of gas, Dad?"
Drake McBride had chortled with confidence.
"Only an idiot could lose money in the oil business." "You said the same damn thing when you were selling real estate,"
his father had reminded him coldly.
"Or trying to sell real estate. It's not my fault the market went sour. Get real, boy. You couldn't sell an igloo to an Eskimo,"
his dad had said.
"Red Diamond is my last act of charity. If you come crawling back here with another lame sob story, you might as well change your name to Drake Chowderhead and sign up for bartender school. Because I'm done with you. Now go find some oil. Hurry up."
Because the competition in Texas was fierce, and also because he owned a waterfront condo on Tampa Bay, Drake McBride chose Florida as headquarters for the new Red Diamond Energy Corporation. His first move was hiring Jimmy Lee Bayless, recently retired from ExxonMobil, to teach him about oil exploration and run the day-to-day operation so that Drake McBride could concentrate on water skiing and fishing. It was Jimmy Lee Bayless who'd explained to Drake McBride that Florida's richest petroleum deposits lay miles offshore and were controlled by giant companies who'd been battling for years to get drilling permits. The drilling was opposed by most Floridians, who didn't want to risk having their beaches choked with black tar in the event of an accidental oil spill.
"Oh, forget about what's under the ocean," Drake McBride said and handed a newspaper clipping to Jimmy Lee Bayless. "Here's where the fast money is, my friend."
Jimmy Lee Bayless frowned at the headline.
"The Everglades."
"Keep reading, partner."
According to the article, the U.S. government had announced a plan to buy up the drilling rights for oil and natural gas beneath the vast Big Cypress Preserve to protect the vanishing wetlands from future damage.
"All we've got to do is find some oil, any oil," Drake McBride said excitedly. "And Uncle Sam will pay us a fortune not to pump it. Isn't that the wildest dang thing you ever heard of?"
"Sure is," said Jimmy Lee Bayless, who was immediately leery of the scheme.
"Tell me this isn't a great country,"
Drake McBride exclaimed.
"But we don't own any drilling leases in the Everglades."
"Your job is to get me one,"
Drake McBride said, poking Jimmy Lee Bayless in the chest.
"And make it a winner."
The tasks turned out to be frustrating and complicated. All but a few of the oil leases were held by huge corporations or rich old geezers who practically laughed at Jimmy Lee Bayless's offers. Eventually, he was able to obtain a single 640-acre parcel from a troubled soul named Vincent Trapwick Jr., who was facing trial for embezzlement and was frantically selling everything he owned to pay his lawyers. The Trapwick parcel, known as Section 21, was located east of Naples at a promising location near the Blackvine Swamp. Yet after months of ground testing and half a dozen boreholes, Jimmy Lee Bayless had reached the grim conclusion that Section 21 held barely enough oil to fill a goldfish bowl. The news set badly with Drake McBride, who kicked at his desk so viciously that he tore the python skin on one of his cowboy boots.
"Too bad we don't have Section 22, Jimmy Lee Bayless remarked.
"What?"
Drake McBride perked up.
"Is there serious oil in Section 22?
"That's what the geologists think, but it doesn't matter. The state owns the land," Jimmy Lee Bayless said. "And they ain't selling. It's part of some wildlife preserve."
"But there's oil," they said. "How deep?"
11,000-12,000 feet is their guess. "But as I told you, the state's got the property."
Drake McBride snapped his manicured fingers.
"I got an idea. We sink a pirate well on Section 22, totally secret, then run the pipe underground to our rig on Section 21.
Jimmy Lee Bayless's gut started to churn.
"Sarah, it's not worth the risk. The geologists say there's no more than 900 barrels a day. And it's poor quality, sir. Gooey and full of sulfur."
"I don't care what it looks like or how bad it stinks," said Drake McBride, "as long as it's oil. All we need is genuine Florida crude to drip on some sucker's desk at the Department of the Interior, who will then give us such a jarmungus wad of money for our drilling rights that even my old man will be impressed. You with me?"
"Do I have a choice?"
"Not if you care to remain employed," said Drake McBride.
And that's how the Section 22 scam had been born. Now Jimmy Lee Bayless squinted through the open hatch of the helicopter, his line of vision following a row of small pink flags that marked the path under which the illegal pipeline would travel from Section 22 to Section 21. The small drill rig would be concealed in a tall stand of bald cypress and would be practically invisible even from the air. Because Section 22 was so wild and remote, Drake McBride didn't worry about getting busted for hijacking the state of Florida's oil. Jimmy Lee Bayless, however, was highly concerned. If just one wayward hiker made a wrong turn in the Black Vine Swamp, the Red Diamond drilling scheme might unravel, and Jimmy Lee Bayless could wind up sharing a 10-by-10 jail cell with Drake McBride. The thought made Jimmy Lee Bayless's stomach pitch, and it pushed him to take extreme measures. He wasn't a crook by nature, but the lure of making millions of dollars by not pumping oil had been too juicy for even him to resist. Still, ever since agreeing to Drake McBride's sleazy scheme, Jimmy Lee Bayless hadn't had a good night's sleep. The disturbing incident involving Melton had only worsened his jitters. Gluing a man naked to a tree didn't seem like something an ordinary thief would do. So Jimmy Lee Bayless had decided to make daily patrols by helicopter over the wetlands, scouting for signs of intruders. So far, he'd turned up nothing.
"You about ready to head back?"
the pilot asked.
"Sure, drop me off in my truck," said Jimmy Lee Bayless. As the chopper gently touched down on the dirt road, Jimmy Lee Bayless was surprised to see a cherry red SUV parked next to his pickup. The SUV had a set of emergency lights mounted on the cab and the initials CCFD painted on the sides. It took a few moments for Jimmy Lee Bayless to realize that the letters stood for Collier County Fire Department. He chewed up four more Tums tablets before climbing out of the chopper. The fire investigator's name was Torkelson. He had thinning blonde hair and a handshake that could crush walnuts. He wanted to chat about the fire in Section 22.
"We work in Section 21, Jimmy Lee Bayless said quickly.
"Yes, I know. We were wondering if you or your men saw anything suspicious in the area that day."
"Like what?"
"Like any person or persons who weren't supposed to be there."
Torkelson spoke in a mild, official tone that made Jimmy Lee Bayless uncomfortable. "My crew was on another site when the wildfire broke out," he said. "I was with them."
"It wasn't a wildfire, Mr. Bayless. It was arson."
"What?" Jimmy Lee Bayless tried to hide his shock so that the fire investigator wouldn't know that he was in danger of soiling his pants.
"Arson? That's crazy,"
he said with a weak laugh.
"What's the point of torching a swamp?"
Torkelson shrugged.
"People do crazy things sometimes. You recognize this?"
He held up a plastic ballpoint pen stamped with the name of Red Diamond Energy. For a moment, Jimmy Lee Bayless thought he might puke his breakfast muffins all over the fire investigator's shoes.
"Yeah, that's mine," he croaked. "It must have fell from my pocket while I was shooting pictures from the helicopter."
Which was a lie, of course. Torkelson seemed to buy it.
"No big deal. We're just trying to run down every lead," the investigator said. "We found the pen about 150 yards from where the fire flashed up."
"Well, you can keep it. I got a whole box of them."
Jimmy Lee Bayless was trying to sound casual and worried. Torkelson dropped the Red Diamond pen into a large manila envelope and took out a small photograph.
"Could you take a look at this, too?"
he asked.
It was a police mugshot of a pimply teenaged kid,
whom Jimmy Lee Bayless didn't recognize. In the picture, the kid looked surly and uncooperative, a pose that reminded Jimmy Lee Bayless of his own boys when they were that age.
"This is the guy who started the fire?" he asked Torkelson.
"He's a person of interest."
"Is that the same thing as a suspect?"
"Between you and me, yes, he's a suspect,"
Torkelson said.
"His name is Dwayne Scrott, Jr., a local punk who likes to play with matches. He'd been arrested before. Sheriff's office gave us a tip that he might have been in this area on the day of the arson."
But now Jimmy Lee Bayless had steadied himself. As he examined the photograph of Dwayne Scrott, Jr., an idea took root in his mind.
"He got into a hassle with one of his teachers," the fire investigator went on. "The next day, there was a school field trip to the swamp, but our boy, Dwayne, didn't show up for the bus. We're trying to find out if he snuck out here and set the fire."
"As payback, you mean," Jimmy Lee Bayless said.
"That's the theory," said Torkelson. "Apparently this kid is somebody you definitely don't want to piss off."
Jimmy Lee Bayless beheld the photo of the student as if it were a gift from the heavens. A real arsonist was exactly what he needed now. Never had Jimmy Lee Bayless expected anyone to figure out that the blaze at the Black Vine Swamp was intentional, because he'd worked so hard to make it look like a wildfire. The purpose was to scare off the kids on that field trip before one of them blundered into Section 22 and spotted Red Diamond's mud pit and drilling equipment. The students were never in serious danger in Jimmy Lee Bayless's view. It was a controlled burn, with a dirt berm and a watery slough providing a barrier between the flames and the hikers. A whiff or two of smoke had done the trick. The teachers had lined up the kids and filed out of the swamp in less than 10 minutes. Jimmy Lee Bayless had watched through his binoculars, a red bandana covering his mouth and nose. Afterward, he'd stayed until the fire burned itself out, and then he cleared the scene of all evidence, or so he'd believed. He was furious at himself for having dropped that stupid ballpoint pen while setting the fire. How could he have been so careless? Drake McBride would blow a gasket if he found out.
"You sure it was arson?" Jimmy Lee Bayless asked Torkelson.
"We found a suspicious line of flash marks in the underbrush," the investigator said.
Jimmy Lee Bayless was glad that he'd taken the trouble to throw his butane torch into a canal along Route 29 on the way home that night. As a result, the only direct evidence linking him to the arson was now rusting in 30 feet of muddy, alligator-infested water. The best news of all, however, was that the fire department had zeroed in on a suspect other than Jimmy Lee Bayless. This scrod boy was obviously a bad egg. Maybe he was the one who'd attacked poor Melton, thought Jimmy Lee Bayless. Getting a goon like that off the streets would be a public service.
"Well, what do you think?"
Torkelson nodded toward the photograph in the oil man's hand, which was now barely shaking at all.
"Ever seen that young man hanging around out here?"
"I believe I have," Jimmy Lee Bayless said, furrowing his brow in fake concentration. "Matter of fact, I'm sure of it."
13. Nick spent most of the teacher work day exercising his free arm, washing his mother's car and helping her scrub the oven. Luckily, she didn't ask how he and Marta liked the movie that they never went to see. Later, Nick rode his bike to the public library and checked out a book by Edward Abbey, the writer mentioned by the stranger who'd caught Nick and Marta inside Mrs. Starch's house. The afternoon was sunny but cool, so Nick practiced pitching left-handed into a net until dark. His arm felt like cement by the time he went to bed. He was so exhausted that he fell asleep after reading only a few pages of the book, which was called The Monkey Wrench Gang. He woke up early the next morning and called the Army Hospital in Washington, D.C. He was eager to know if the infection in his dad's injured shoulder had gotten better. A nurse who answered the phone in the hospital room told Nick that Captain Gregory Waters was gone, but said she wasn't allowed to give out any other information. Nick immediately tried to reach his mom at work with no luck. Deep in worry, he sat by himself on the bus to Truman, barely mumbling hello to Marta and his other friends. All morning, Nick remained so preoccupied that he was unable to focus on his schoolwork, including the topic of punctuated equilibrium. That was the featured term on page 329 of Nick's biology book, and on Thursdays, Dr. Wendell Waxmo always taught page 329, and only page 329. Punctuated equilibriums had something to do with how animal species change over time, but even Libby Marshall was having difficulty explaining it. Wendell Waxmo scanned the room for a fresh target and called not once but three times on Nick, who was in a fog.
"All right, Mr. Waters, stand up,"
Wendell Waxmo barked finally.
"And sing along with me."
Jarred into alertness, Nick was too mortified to move.
"Even with one arm tied behind your back, I'll bet you can carry a swell tune," said Wendell Waxmo.
"No, I can't, honest."
"Bridge over troubled water?"
"I don't know all the words to that one, sorry," Nick said. The whole class was watching him except for Smoke, whose nose was buried in his textbook.
White Christmas? The crazy substitute said. For heaven's sake, every human over the age of 3 knows White Christmas by heart.
Please don't make me sing. Not today. Nick had the strange sensation of physically shrinking at his desk, growing smaller with each agonizing moment. He thought, if only I could make myself disappear.
Well,
said Wendell Waxmore, I just can't do it.
And why not, Mr. Waters?
Because I...
Because why?
Because he's not in the mood. It was Marta, shooting to her feet. The other students sat stunned and gaping. Even Wendell Waxmore was briefly flustered. He fiddled with his bow tie. Today's color selection was lime green, before collecting his wits and boring in on Marta.
Miss Gonzalez, it's nice to have you participating finally in a class discussion. Would you mind telling us how you happen to know that Mr. Waters isn't in the mood for singing?
Marta glanced sideways at Nick, who nodded for her to sit down. He appreciated what she was trying to do, spare him from an incredibly awkward moment, but he didn't want her to get in trouble.
I'm waiting, Miss Gonzalez.
Wendell Waxmore brushed at the lapels of his tattered old tuxedo.
Kindly tell us why your friend doesn't feel like belting out a song.
Because his father got blown up in Iraq, Marta said quietly, and nearly died. So leave him alone, okay? Just leave him alone. Wendell Waxmore looked as if a bowling ball had been dropped on his toes. His mouth froze in the shape of an O, and the sound that it merged was a long, faint hiss, like a tire going flat. Nick didn't know what to do. Most of the kids were looking at him with expressions of sympathy and sorrow. Even Smoke had closed his book and was studying Nick from across the room. Marta sat down, her eyes glistening with tears. She scribbled a note and thrust it at Nick. I want Mrs. Starch to come back. Gradually, the color returned to Wendell Waxmo's face, and he cleared his throat much too loudly and moistly. Once again, he'd been upstaged in his own class, only this time the circumstances didn't allow for a witty retort.
Mr. Waters, our sincere prayers are with your father and your family. War is a tragic event, the substitute said. But life does go on. So, people, please return your attention to page 329 and the theory of punctuated equilibrium.
Nick raised his left hand.
Yes, Mr. Waters?
My dad's going to be okay, Nick declared in a strong voice. The doctors say he'll be fine. Wendell Waxmore hoped the boy's upbeat attitude would energize the rest of the class.
What good news, he said. I think that calls for a round of applause.
The students stared at the man as if his pants had fallen down. Wendell Waxmore looked at the clock on the wall, 9 long minutes until the bell.
One piece of unfinished business, he said briskly.
From his battered briefcase, he removed the essay written by Duane Scrod, Jr., upon which the brutal grade of D-plus had been scrawled, supersized, with a bright red marker. It was painfully visible to all members of the class, even those in the back row. Wendell Waxmore waved the paper in Smoke's face and said,
"Pimples indeed, Mr. Scrod."
The essay was covered with crimson slashes, circles, and scribbles. "It wasn't even my idea," the boy said. "Mrs. Starch is the one who made me write it."
"Well, she's not here, is she?"
"But how'd I mess up so bad?"
"In a word, scholarship, or lack thereof. I'm going to leave this disaster in Mrs. Starch's desk so she can see for herself."
Wendell Waxmore returned to the front of the class and placed the pimple paper in Mrs. Starch's top drawer. The other students remained silent, but the mood was definitely hostile. Nick saw Marta trying to write another note, the veins in her neck pulsing with anger. Finally, she crumpled it in mouth the words, "I hate him." Nick, too, felt bad for Smoke, who seemed floored by the D-plus grade. Crazy Dr. Waxmoe should have waited until after the bell to return the essay instead of embarrassing the kid in front of everybody. Smoke raised his hand. Wendell Waxmoe called on Graham, who wasn't expecting it.
Mr. Carson, tell the class how punctuated equilibrium relates to the concept of speciation.
Graham stood up and confidently gave a totally wrong answer, as usual. Smoke raised his hand higher. Wendell Waxmoe looked the other way and called on Mickey Maris. Nick couldn't stand it. He cleared his throat and spoke up. Duane has a question, Dr. Waxmoe.
What?
The substitute wheeled around and speared Nick with a glare.
Are you interrupting me, Mr. Waters?
Nick gestured toward Smoke. Duane's had his hand up.
Am I blind, am I?
No, sir.
Whatever Duane wants to ask can wait, I'm sure.
Nick said, that's not right. Yeah, answer his question, said Marta. Wendell Waxmoe's ears turned pink, and his bald spot began to tingle, and his tuxedo shirt began to itch. What had gotten into these kids? It was unbelievable. He banged a pudgy fist on the desk and said,
Quiet, you little termites!
At that moment, there was a firm rap on the door, and Dr. Dressler entered the room. He pointed at Nick and said,
Mr. Waters, I need to see you in my office right away.
Twilly Spree had been born in Key West 34 years before the Red Diamond Energy Corporation came probing around the Big Cypress. Twilly's father was a gung-ho real estate salesman. His mother grew bonsai trees and wrote a dreadful romance novel that she published under the pseudonym Rosalie DuPont. When Twilly was 18, his grandfather had died suddenly, leaving the young man a generous inheritance.